You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
You were supposed to be in Istanbul last night. I'm afraid this unfortunate lighter business has clouded your judgment. You have a job to do. I expect you on a plane this afternoon.
I haven't finished here, sir.
Leave it to the Americans. It's their mess. Let them clear it up.
Sir, they're not going to do anything. I owe it to Leiter. He's put his life on the line for me many times.
Oh, spare me this sentimental rubbish. He knew the risks.
And his wife?
This private vendetta of yours could easily compromise Her Majesty's government. You have an assignment, and I expect you to carry it out objectively and professionally.
Then you have my resignation, sir.
We're not a country club, 007. Effective immediately. Your license to kill is revoked. And I require you to hand over your weapon. Now. I need hardly remind you that you're still bound by the Official Secrets Act.
I guess it's a farewell to arms.
Welcome back to the 602 Club, coming at you live from a small little country south of the border, Isthmus. I'm so excited to be here as we'll be talking about some James Bond. That's right, we are back with 007, and sadly, also the end of the Timothy Dalton era. It's like we barely began, guys.
Right? I mean, it's so minimal for such a wonderful person coming into this role. I mean, so different than Roger Moore and so serious, but so cool.
Look, I'm just going to suggest just go back and watch Lion in Winter and The Rocketeer and Flash Gordon to get your Timothy Dalton fix.
And then in the future, Beautician and the Beast, which is my recommendation.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, and he's on the show Chuck. He's great in Chuck as well. And he's on there for like a whole season, so you can get a lot of Timothy Dalton. The Rocketeer, man, that's, I think, maybe one of the first places I saw him is in The Rocketeer. So, super excited to dive into License to Kill tonight. Before we do that, just remember, you can find all the shows that we're doing here on the network all over the place, but the best place to go is Apple Podcasts, and you can find us at itunes.com/TrekFM. All of our shows are there. And of course, while you're there, hit the 602 Club up with a star rating review. It's been a while since we've had one and definitely helps people find the show. So help us out that way. And if you do, we'll call you out in the show. You can find us on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at Facebook.com/TrekFM. We're all, the hosts here, we're all on our listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference, where you can have a discussion with every fan that's joined. Now, if you're on Facebook, type in Babel, and you'll find the group. And if you're on the website at trek.fm, click discussion on any of the menu bars, and that would bring you over to that group, and we can let you in. And then last but not least, a great way to contact us is to go over to trek.fm/contact. If you choose a show, you choose the 602 Club, that sends an email to me and then any of the hosts that were on that week, and we can converse with you that way. It's a lot of fun to get the emails from people, their thoughts, what you're thinking, you know, maybe you have ideas of what we should do. So check us out all over the place, and make sure you're liking us and following us and all those social medias, and helping tell your friends about Trek FM. But guys, we're continuing Bond, and as we said, this is Dalton's second film. And one of the things that I thought was most interesting is that they realize, and Timothy Dalton seems to have a real impact on the creative team, they realize this Bond is different. They realize Timothy is different. So they need to write for him. And they really are striving here to go back to Fleming and to create what many have called maybe one of the closest to the Fleming character. And kind of what we get with Timothy Dalton. And so that was one of the things I thought was really interesting. And specifically, you know, John Glenn, he's really directing the writers to match this, you know, hard-edged, down-to-earth Bond. And I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I love the more hard-edge Bond, honestly. Not that I didn't love Roger Moore, but this feeling that, you know, he's been through some things. And, you know, even though it's not behooving in his business to have connections and friends because you could lose them, he does still, you know, as I think that anyone would, have people that he cares about and that he doesn't want to lose. And I think that you see that over and over again in the last film, but especially in this one. I like that they had Felix mention, yeah, Bond was married one time before. And even though it's terrifying seeing, you know, Felix possibly dying and that his wife does, you're seeing this side of Bond again where he's been through some things and, you know, he's got a score to settle.
Yeah, same. Timothy Dalton grounds Bond in a way that we've not seen up until now. And even though Connery played a more serious Bond that got more fantastical as those movies went on, he was still a guy in this sort of slick comic book world of James Bond. And then Roger Moore, they lightened the mood a bit. Even with George Lazenby, he was still having fun when they let the character have fun. This Bond feels so a part of the real world. And even just simple things like the wardrobe that Timothy Dalton has. You get him in the nice tuxedo once, but you also get this Bond in, you know, a t-shirt and khakis. And you get him just sort of being very much a part of the environment that he's in instead of being the standout, you know, best looking, best dressed guy in the room at all times.
That sticks out like a sore thumb.
Right, right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Like that one time in Harlem.
Yeah. No, but you really feel like he lives there and like his motivations are true to the character, true to what he's been through. So I appreciate that throughout this movie and throughout Dalton's tenure as Bond, but particularly in this movie.
Yeah, I think there's I like what you said, John. There's a sense of reality, you know. I mean, even when the movie brings in Q, there's a sense of that, like the technology that Q's using, it doesn't seem outlandish. It seems like something that you could actually build and create and make work with the technology.
Although I'll take exception to one piece of technology, which is he shows off that camera that transforms into a gun. And it's really cool that they have the fingerprint technology built into the hand. That makes a lot of sense. It's very smart. But it was funny to me that Q goes to the great lengths to show that it just looks like an ordinary camera, yet it's a gun. All the other pieces look exactly like a gun.
The scope.
Yes, look precisely like a gun. Yeah.
Oh yes, absolutely, 100% look like a gun. No, Rogue Nation flute gun here. That
not
just
even
like
a man with a golden gun where you have a pen and a lighter and a cigarette case.
No. This is something that was interesting too, because they also, as they're writing the movie, they're also thinking about locations, and they wanted to film the movie in China. And so I wanted to ask you how you felt about that idea. Do you feel that maybe that would have added a bit of pizzazz to the movie? Because, you know, I feel like going kind of south of the border in Mexico doesn't seem as exotic as being, you know, hoping to have a chase on the Great Wall, you know, or the Terracotta Army, you know, have a showdown there. So do you feel like that would have benefited the movie if they had been able to find a way to bring this drug trade thing into China?
I think it just doesn't make as much sense if you have it filmed in China. Although, you know, of course, the Great Wall, the terracotta soldiers and all of that would be cool. And the scenery, I mean, man, you have a lot to work with in China. But I think that because they've chosen this villain that's in the drug trade, and that they've gone with names like Sanchez and Lupe and stuff, it just makes more sense for the story to have a setting that's a Latin country than it would to be having a drug trade thing going on in China, to me.
I think it hurts a little bit that you start the movie in Key West. So you go from tropical location to tropical location, and it's a little bit too much of the same. So I would have liked to have seen part of the movie elsewhere, or if you're going to do a South American thing, keep going. Go to El Salvador, go to Ecuador, go to some place where you have even more lush, beautiful, exotic locations. I'm a little lukewarm on it. It makes sense to the character, and it makes sense to the contemporary feel of the movie. But I think they're hurt by their location the more they stay in that location. And particularly when you get to the end and you have the Wayne Newton religious temple and all of this stuff, it feels like they're sort of stretching the budget. And I felt like that actually early on in the movie, too, where a lot of the scenes in Key West, particularly around Felix Leiter's house, where it felt very much like a set and the lighting was very flat and it just felt a little too made for TV. So if they had jazzed it up a little bit, maybe a change of location would have worked, or maybe just a little more careful attention to those settings. Thematically, it works, but it felt like a little too much of the same.
Yeah, maybe a place like Brazil would have been better.
See, there you go. I mean, look how beautiful that was in Moonraker, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I do agree, like, it just, in the scenes especially, like you said, at Felix's house, I think at one point when they're showing Bond going into Felix's office again, it looks like he's going into a building on a set with a backdrop of a sunset.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't even look like it's real. So.
And here's the thing. I know that not everybody in the James Bond audience lives in the U.S. Clearly, it's the biggest film franchise around the world for a reason. But I don't want my James Bond in Florida. I want my James Bond in Macau or in Berlin or in anywhere else. You know, I don't want him in Florida. I really don't.
That was the part that so I brought up the question because when I was thinking, oh wow, you know, if we had gone from Felix's wedding in Florida in the Key West, which is a gorgeous place. I mean, the scenery when they
and
are
I love
outside,
they use the Hemingway house. That's super cool. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So all of that is great. But then if you had then made the transition to the East in China, you know, the Far East, I think it would have created a nice juxtaposition.
But I will say this, you know, they could have made the character of Sanchez somebody else and set that character in the East.
Right, absolutely.
But it's really nice for the time that we are in South America that we're on Sanchez's turf. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what's really cool. Those scenes of Bond waking up in his at once beautiful and horrendously bizarre home, you know, all of that stuff is pretty effective. So had that been a different character of a different nationality and they just move him elsewhere, yes, you can have a drug trade coming out of China or coming out of Hong Kong or coming out of Thailand or whatever. But I like the dynamic they got out of the relationship between Bond and Sanchez.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things that really struck me is that, you know, the movie has a smaller scope to it, but what I felt like that it's not a detriment to the film because the movie is kind of a smaller scope in the sense that this is kind of more personal for Bond, right, too. So it's not about the locations and everything. This is really a movie about a man coming to grips with trying to avenge his best friend's wife's death and the almost, you know, the end of his best friend. And so, you know, actually going to Mexico, and they actually shoot and film on location in Mexico. And this is the only movie that they don't, in the first movie, they don't film at Pinewood. So, there are some places where I think you can tell that with the set work, it's not quite the same. But I also, you know, John, you were mentioning the flatness of some of this stuff. I feel like that's just, it kind of fit the very late 80s too. So it feels right for that time period. You know, for things to not be flashy, because the very late 80s and very early 90s, there's absolutely nothing flashy going on in the world.
Well, that's
right
true.
Then. Like, it's just, it's not a pretty world when it comes to, like, the fashion. Yeah,
that was definitely an 80s wedding.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of that stuff, I don't know, the late 80s and early 90s, some of it just feels tacky anyway. And so it kind of worked for me in that sense that we were in this kind of milieu that's not quite the fashionable Bond. But then again, when you're writing for Dalton, Dalton's not a flashy Bond. He's more like the character in the novel, which is this hard-nosed, stone-cold killer who is there anything alive inside? And that's what we're trying to get to. I feel like this movie, at least with what they end up trying to do here, that's what they're going for, at least. So, and I guess we'll talk about, obviously, if they get there, you know?
Yeah, I love that this is Bond going rogue and not on assignment. And, you know, his license to kill has been revoked, which, you know, I mean, who doesn't love that phrase anyway? Perfect name for this movie. But, you know, it is so personal for him, and he's got something to lose and has lost something. And it just really gives a whole nother dynamic to this movie and to Bond, I think.
One of the things, you know, obviously this is the point where we're not pulling direct stories from Fleming, but because Glenn and the writers were very kind of keen to go back to that feel because of Timothy Dalton, they actually pulled a scene from Fleming's Live and Let Die where Felix is mauled by a shark. And they kind of use that as the impetus for the movie for Bond going rogue. And then, of course, they add, you know, his wife being killed by this drug lord and wrapping that. And what I kind of liked about the movie is how the story wraps in the idea that Bond gets wrapped into Felix's work, not the other way around. So Bond is actually continuing the work that Felix has been doing for the CIA. Instead of it being actually a mission that he had been sent on, this is something that Felix has been putting all together, and he's just following all those clues. And of course, like you said, he goes rogue. So first, just want to get it. How do you feel about the feel of this movie? Because for the most part, there are a couple places where it's not, but this is a very gritty, very dark, much more violent movie than I think we've ever gotten before in Bond. Do you feel like that works for the movie, or did they take it too far? What do you guys think?
I think it comes down to what is motivating Bond this time around. So regardless of the trappings, regardless of the plot that we've set up, really for the first time, we've got Bond acting purely on his gut. And purely on a mission that drives him. The other missions, and particularly when you look back at the Roger Moore period, Bond can essentially wash his hands of everything that's going on. He's a step removed from everything that's happening. Yes, it's a bad guy threatening the world, but it's not about him. It's not about what drives him. Here we get a guy whose whole world is turned upside down. And we question all along whether or not Bond does have real relationships. Does he have real friendships? And the only one that we've had established throughout the entire series is Felix. yes, played by different actors all the time, but I'm glad they brought back David Hedison from mm-hmm. Live and Let Die to give us some sort of anchor, some sort of grounding to that, some consistency with Bond in the past. But I think that's what changes everything here. It's just really about getting inside Bond's head. And at every turn, you know, there's a great scene where Bond has convinced Sanchez that Crest is the guy who stole the money from him. And now he can step back and Sanchez is going to kill Crest. That's one more thing off of his list. That's one more way to get to Sanchez. That's one more way to destabilize what Sanchez's operation is, right? And the next morning, Sanchez comes in and Bond has snuck back into bed in Sanchez's place. And he says to Sanchez, you know, I just thought that nobody would be crazy enough to go up against you on your own or on their own. And it's such a good moment because, of course, Bond is playing it straight. Well, Timothy Dalton is playing it as Bond playing it straight. But we know what's in Bond's head. That in Bond's head, he would strangle this guy with his own hands, given the right opportunity to do it. But he's playing this out, and he's waiting for exactly the right opportunity. And he wants to see this guy crumble apart in front of him. So I love the idea that instead of just Bond goes on a mission to kill the bad guy, this is us inside the psychology of Bond when he has been driven by something he has not been driven by before. And I would even include to an extent, you know, we saw Tracy get killed at the end of Honor Majesty's Secret Service. But we really don't see what happens to Bond after that. We recognize that this thing happened to Bond. We recognize down the road, we reference, and like you just said, Christy, even in this movie, we reference that he was married before. But we really don't see the repercussions of that. So this is a rarity where everything in the past, everything else that made up this character is now off the table.
I think that was a really good point. And to piggyback off of that, too, I will say I think that it, in a lot of ways, does really make sense that they go as far as they did with how the deaths happen to each of the different characters and how Felix gets injured and almost killed himself. But it did feel like they still were a little bit too far for my taste, you know, with Crest being blown apart by the pressure. And it just felt like the deaths were a lot more bloody in this movie than really needed to be shown. It could be implied.
There's a lot of blood. A lot of blood in Crest. Yeah.
But I do think that it fits that tone that he's really upset and has, you know, a legitimate reason to be seeking revenge. But I think that something that we haven't pointed out yet that is really great about Dalton in this role is that he is playing out such control at all these times when he could have and wanted to wring all these people by the neck, that he's saying, no, I'm going to wait until the time is right.
I think it's, interesting that John, you know, you've talked about Anthony Zerbe getting his face stretched off twice in very few weeks.
Yeah,
you know,
with
Insurrection and this. One of the things I really actually enjoy about this movie is the gritty, dark nature, the more violent feel, because when we're talking about the people that Bond is up against here, these are the ruthless people. You know, these are they're just kind of the worst, right? In the sense of they are willing to do whatever it takes to make sure that their business goes through. One, the trade that they're in is one to get people willingly addicted to their substance, knowing that it will destroy their lives. But as long as they're making millions of dollars, they don't care. So they're already kind of the worst in that way. But then, of course, the way that they treat people, too, is not great, because everything to them is about power and possession. And we clearly see that with Sanchez. And, you know, the moment you think anybody's crossed you, it becomes that macho, you know, I have to take them out kind of thing. And so I really like that they don't hold back from showing just how bad these people are, what they're willing to do. And they put on a facade of grandeur, right? I mean, on the outside, Sanchez, if you just saw him walking down the street or whatever, you know, he just seemed like, you know, a nice rich dude, you know? He's got a nice watch, you know, he's got a pretty lady on his arm, right? Yeah, but that pretty lady can't wear a dress too low in her on her back, because then you'd see where he beat her, you know? Like, so that's just where we get to, and I think that that's really, and having just watched American Made with Tom Cruise, where he's drug running with the CIA during this time period, and you see how bad these guys are and that, and what they're willing to do to people, this felt like that. And I felt like that adding that part to the story and really putting Bond, I would say this may be the first time that Bond feels real, because there's not anything in this movie that isn't real, that brings you out and you're like, oh, well, that's just the Bond thing, right? You know, because there really isn't. I didn't feel that in this one. So it really does feel like this is the first time that Bond could legitimately be any agent from around the world and any super spy. And this is what they do, you know, because he's not all that glamorous. He's never really, he wears a tuxedo once, like you said, John, but the story is based around these things of like you said, kind of digging into who Bond is and his psyche. And I kind of like, too, that we see Bond's adaptability, because as, okay, shooting Sanchez doesn't work, he just keeps rolling with the punches. I mean, you know, rolling in with the satin sheets that he gets thrown in. And he, like you said, he finds this way in to start dismantling this organization from within without really having to do anything, just kind of feeding misinformation. And so I just, the whole thing, to me, it's one of the better Bond stories. Like, when you think about the plot lines and how all the characters fit in, you know, like, with starting with Felix, and he's the one who's been after Sanchez, and you moved that he's been working with this informant, Pam, you know, and how she fits into the story. And, like, when you start thinking through all the story elements, they all fit together really nicely. And this is maybe one of the best Bond stories, I think, that we've gotten in quite a long time, especially since we trudged through, you know, the end of the Moore era, where the stories were definitely the parts, for the most part, that were kind of really lacking. So I just, yeah, there's a lot that I love in this movie. And then, of course, we're ripping things from the headlines. Drug barons, you know, we've got Sanchez, who looks like Noriega, you know? I mean, all of that stuff, to me, is working on all cylinders.
Yeah, I agree with you completely as far as that goes. I like I said, my only thing against it was feeling like the deaths were a little bloody. But I think that you're right, that it's believable for the kind of villain you have, that he just has no regard for anyone's life, not even his girlfriend. So why would any of that matter to him? It's like when the guy says, but boss, what about the money? And he says, launder it.
Launder it. That's so good. So good. Yep.
What did you guys think about, I mean, because we talked about the story, what did you guys specifically think about some of these villains? And I thought we'd start with some of the lower rung villains, and then we'll move our way up. So I love that Benicio del Toro is in this movie. And he is so good at being scary creepy in this film. It's just, it's awesome. It's really
awesome. It's weird,
awesome.
First of all, seeing him so young, because I've never seen anything with him at this age. And then after just seeing him recently in The Last Jedi, it was kind of funny to be seeing another movie with Benicio in it. But yeah, I mean, he really, I feel like, kind of stole the show from the other lesser villains than Sanchez, because he's got that creepy grin down to a T, and with his accent and everything, the way that he says, you know, his line delivery is extra creepy. So I think that his character, Dario, was my favorite, and that I didn't care for Sanchez as much as I liked him.
Yeah, I not much more to add there, except that this was really early in his career, and he's very young looking. He kind of looks like he stepped out of a catalog. You know, he's this nice looking guy, but something's a little off about him. And you can tell that out of all the henchmen, he's the psychopath. So, you know, yeah, he's kind of wonderful in this.
When he says, "We gave her a knife."
Yeah, right? Yeah, so cute. Right.
I mean, it's like the creepiest thing, because you are imagining the worst possible things at that moment that they've done to his wife before they killed her. It's it's not good. And I think, like you said, John, clear psychopath. And that's the thing I think that fits so well with the story. Like, he is perfectly cast to give you that, you know, henchman, I don't care, I will do whatever it takes, and I'm going to enjoy it too. Like, I'm not going to just do it, I'm going to enjoy what I do. And I think that was one of the scariest parts to it. So yeah, he's fantastic. I liked, I think Anthony Zerbe is really well cast here as Milton Crest, because he's just kind of swarmy and slimy, and like the guy who doesn't really want to be doing this job, but it pays, you know, and like he doesn't want to get his hands too dirty. He just wants to get paid. I thought he really acts. I forgot how I felt like good he is in this role.
And don't forget that, you know, you mentioned Insurrection. Let's not overlook the great Anthony Zerbe performance from Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, ABC Television, 1978, in which he was the mastermind behind the evil animatronic Kiss robots that were going to take over the theme park. I think we're remiss. In fact, I'm just going to suggest that on 602 Club, just go ahead and dedicate about a month of coverage to Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, starring not only the rock band Kiss, but Anthony Zerbe as the terrifying creator, the mad mastermind behind the plot to take over the theme park. No, he's great. I love that in this movie he seems, I mean, well, she says at one point, Lupe says, "You're drunk." Really, through about half of his performance, he seems like he's off, like he's a little bit drunk. And like,
oh yeah, he seems like he might be using some of the product. Yeah. You know,
it's like one eye is a little off, you know, and he just seems a little sloppy. But it's perfect. It's perfect that he's clearly not the guy in charge. He's got some level of power, but he's just kind of a mess. He's sort of lucky to be in the position that he's in, even. Yeah, he's good. He's so good.
And especially the scene, I think, that really you feel that is when he is talking with Lupe on the boat. It really just grosses you out, makes your skin crawl that he's touching her.
Yes, yes, 100%.
I love that idea too, John, that he's been doing a little sniffing in the cabin. Yeah.
That's
and
believable.
He's just kind of like, he looks like he's like the Jack Sparrow, you know, but with less jokes. No, he is great. Okay, so guys, we got to get to him. I mean, he's kind of a villain, right? He's part of the plan.
Wayne Newton. Don't you want to give to the meditation center?
I want to go meet him as well. Maybe get, you know, led into the private meditation room. I mean, I don't know about you,
he's
but
he's gonna try to seduce you. Okay, clearly he already has.
Probably
clearly
is.
He already has.
Yeah. I think that he fits so well in that particular character because of, you know, I guess knowing from my visit to Las Vegas that he, I think, still has his show running there if he hasn't retired yet. It seemed like a Las Vegas show set when he's doing that whole TV bit, pull out your phones. So it felt very natural for a person like Wayne Newton to play that role. And having the creepy pencil mustache and the white suit and, you know, I mean, he really does make it feel like you're giving to this charity and we're so much in need. And if you would just pull out your phones, it was perfect.
I'm a little bit torn about this. I mean, I love Wayne Newton. I love anything that's cheesy Vegas Americana. I really do. And of course, I love my James Bond movies. There's something about this that is simultaneously awful and perfect in him mm-hmm. being this character. He's really good. It's just the funniest thing in the world and the best thing in the world when he's getting one over on him all the time, and bless your heart, he's mm-hmm. still staying in that yeah. weird, skeevy televangelist character no matter what.
He's so sincere about it, right? Like, he just, like, bless your heart.
He's pretty great. But at the same time, there's something I feel like this movie is, and we'll wrap all of this up when we get to that point in the show, but I might be jumping ahead a bit here to say that, Matt, I agree with you 100% that this story is spot on for a Bond film. I think as a movie, as a production, it's not the best Bond film. And part of it is this weird sort of back and forth where they don't really know where to spend their budget. They don't really have a grasp on what they want their locations and set pieces to look like and feel like. It's very inconsistent in that way. And I'm jumping ahead of our own timeline here to say, okay, there's a character in later Bond that I think about, and that's Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies. For better or for worse, with that movie, and I happen to really like that movie, so there's mm-hmm. a spoiler for a few months from now, but there's something about the presence that he has in that role as this media magnate, this guy who's very comfortable on TV and comfortable calling the shots. And Wayne Newton here, he's not the guy calling the shots, but he is the figurehead, at least for this part of the organization. That doesn't really ring true. And it feels a little bit like the writers here have a foot in that Moore era comedy relief and a foot in this gritty 90s or late 80s seriousness that they're trying to express. So it doesn't quite ring true to me. So as I was watching this, I kept going back and forth like, okay, do I love Wayne Newton's performance here or do I hate Wayne Newton's performance here? And if I hate it, is it his fault? I don't think it's necessarily his fault. I just think it's the tone of the movie doesn't always find its footing. It doesn't quite know where to land, particularly when you get to him.
Yeah, I think you're right in that sense because I think that what they're doing with the part and how it fits, you know, I grew up in Dallas, right, which is home mm-hmm, of Robert mm-hmm. Tilton, which is one of the biggest ripoff televangelists of all time. So I'm very well aware of this being a total reality. And so I really like that they're actually using that in this and they're using it as a way to run drugs. You know, it's a genius plan because nobody would suspect. I do think that if you had cast somebody else other than Wayne Newton, who I feel like in the role kind of takes over as just he's Wayne Newton being kind of a Wayne Newton-ish type of character. If you had actually cast somebody in there to play the role and play this part and give it something that's not Wayne Newton, it's actually somebody giving this character life, I think that it would have come off better. But again, like, I think that I don't want to take too much away because I really think that the actual part of the story that's happening here all flows pretty well in the sense of like this part makes sense, this role makes sense. It might just be that we needed somebody to come in like Anthony Zerbe does with Crest or you know, Benicio del Toro does with Dario, or we haven't talked about it, but, you know, Robert Davi comes in with Sanchez to give this role a life of its own beyond
the face,
person that we've gotten played. Yeah. So if that had happened, I think we would have been like, oh man, that was great. And I think it would have sold it much better. I do think he brings a cheesiness that doesn't totally fit with the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to give him a little bit more of the benefit and the doubt and say, but that's also kind of, there's a part of me that's like, I'm like you with you, John. Is he playing it amazing or is it just awful? And part of that is because, like, if you watch those, like, really, like, just, pastors, mm-hmm. you know, this is kind of how they come off. So I almost feel like I want to say Wayne Newton's actually doing a genius job.
I don't think
he's not. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard. Right, it's really tough.
I don't think he's doing a bad job. I think he's doing exactly what he was asked to do. I just think tonally the movie isn't quite finding what it's supposed to be there, you know?
Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you.
So that just leaves us with Robert Davi as the guy to talk about.
it does. And I mean, I think with the other three that we talked about beyond Wayne Newton, I think he nails it. I think he's everything he's supposed to be in this movie. He's narcissistic. He's scary. He's exactly what you want a Bond villain to be. And he has, what I love about him too, is the plans that he's had are everything that are realistic to the drug barons of that time period, and probably even the drug barons of this time period of when we're recording. You know, he seems very rooted in reality. And I feel like he plays the part perfectly.
Agree with you. I think that he was a good fit for this role, although, like I said, I like Benicio a little bit better in that character as the henchman. I still think Sanchez is creepy, and you believe that he means what he says when he's going to take somebody out. It's like, you know, I love that he can switch from smiling to killing you in a matter of seconds. But I also like that they gave him this realistic, softer side of, you know, even when he's riding in the back of the armored truck, it's like he's not really worried. He's just hanging out. He knows he's getting picked up soon. He's like, whatever. And then later, too, when he's, you know, in the room in the casino and has the iguana on his shoulder, and he gives a kiss to his girlfriend and says, would you like a kiss, too? I like that they give him those little moments that are kind of funny, but then the rest of the time he is a believable, terrifying, you know, lead villain with this masterful plan.
He plays his character in a way that is the polar opposite of the... well, you know, press orange for murder. He's very different from that type of Bond villain who's just so clearly...
He does his own dirty work.
He's very hands-on.
Clearly the mustache-twirling supervillain. This is not that guy. And for that, you believe him. And he plays all the layers. He plays murderous psychopath, but he also plays the charming guy that you can kind of understand why people are attracted to him. There's a dynamic that they play with him a couple of times that I remembered really well from the first time I saw this, when Truman, his bank toady, is giving the investors a tour of the bank, and he's saying, you know, we have a surplus of $10 million a day come through here, and it's just Sanchez who is throwing in the little one-liner quips after Truman Lodge is giving the business. So Sanchez saying, like, our only trouble is what to do with all the money. And they all laugh at him, and they're all just tolerating Truman, you know?
And can I mention, since you threw in what Zurb did outside of this movie, I remembered the guy that played Truman, Anthony Stark, from the weirdest movie I have ever seen, and I can say that with confidence, Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Wow, nice, nice.
So if you haven't seen that... it is also George Clooney when he's very young in that movie.
Oh, sweet. Sweet. And look, let's face it, Anthony Stark looks like every bad guy from an 80s movie. You know,
like the rich entitled,
like the guy who's going to take over the ski lodge from the kids and, you know, turn it into condos. Like he is that guy pretty much. But yeah, they play those characters. Like Robert Davi plays Sanchez perfectly. Everybody around him is playing perfectly to give Sanchez the sort of weight and the sort of believability that helps you through this movie with him, that helps you through the process of this movie with him. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Matt, he's terrifying. He's dangerous. And it's really difficult to watch some of those scenes with him and particularly with Lupe, Talisa Soto. And then I know that we'll talk about her in a moment too. But every little element of that completes this really complete picture of Sanchez.
And another villain that was in that group that he was marketing to, you know, of all of the Asian businessmen, I noticed was his name is actually Quang in the movie, but it's Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa.
Yes.
I recognized his face. I knew him from Mortal Kombat.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
Yes. He did two Mortal Kombat
Finish
movies.
Him.
He was in The Phantom. He was in Memoirs of a Geisha. Amazing actor, and definitely brought another, you know, really great creepy character to that group.
Nice.
Yeah, that's the thing too. You know, we didn't talk about in the story, but I thought that was really interesting. Is how this story really revolves around so many more people than just Bond's vendetta. Mm-hmm. You know, and we get that through the villains by thinking that, you know, one of these guys is a villain working with Sanchez, and really he's Hong Kong security, narcotics, and Bond actually destroys their case. You know, almost hurts the case that Pam's been working on with the CIA with one of Sanchez's guys. Mm-hmm. To get it inside. So, I mean, what's interesting about the movie and these villains and Bond going after them, I think, is the fact that Bond is on his own, and he's not working for the British government at this point. And he also finds out that his actions are having repercussions on other people's work, the same work that he's supposed to be doing, that he's given up for this revenge. And so I think that's something that's really interesting, and you get that played out as he gets further into this plot with these villains. I thought that was really neat to see. And again, that's a layer of complexity that most Bond movies just don't have. So I think that's really nice as he gets further into the world of the villain and kind of trying to work his revenge. He finds that he's destroying other people's work that he's normally doing. So he would be, I think, quite upset if other people got in his way, you know, and if his normal spy routine. So I really like that. And on the whole, I think the villain lineup here is one of the strongest that we've ever gotten. I mean, we've talked about, like you said, John, press M for murder, you just get this, or press orange for murder, and you just get this, these blasé guys. But you've got three people in this movie, maybe four, depending on where we land on Wayne Newton, where like all of these guys are creating a complex structure of villainy. And each one of them has something else to add. It's like, man, you could have taken almost any of these guys and planted them in another Bond movie, and they could have been a much better Bond villain than some of the ones we got. Mm-hmm. So it's, and we've got a plethora. Would you say we have a plethora of villains?
Yes, LF. I would say you have a plethora of villains.
Do you know what a plethora is?
No, LF.
Oh man, that goes all the way back to our Spectre recording when you brought up his own El Guapo. So bringing it back. So
Bond has some friends along the way, and I love, like you said, John, they bring David Henderson back with Felix. And what I really like about that is, you know, that we're here, we're expanding that character. He's getting married. We're seeing Bond's connection with him is very strong, obviously very strong. His wife, you know, the woman he's marrying, loves James too. Like they both are head over heels for this guy. He's their best friend. And I felt like him being in the movie and that relationship that both Felix and his new wife have with James really sells why you are with James when he goes on this, you know, murdering revenge spree. I really like him being back. I think it was really strong.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it having a different Bond probably they felt like would take people out a little bit, since this is only Dalton's second movie as Bond. So maybe you needed to bring back some familiar characters. And so I think that it was kind of essential that they bring back David as Felix and not having a different actor also playing Felix with a different Bond. And I think it makes you recall back to the other movies David did, so that you do, it does cement that friendship for you more, having a returning actor that you knew pretty well as Felix. I did think it was a little weird how many people were kissing the bride that were not the groom. I was like, that didn't happen at our wedding, honey.
Yeah, and look, let's just not forget that David Henderson is badass. I mean, he was Felix in Live and Let Die. He was in the original The Fly from 1958. He was Lee Crane in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. That man will be 91 years old this year, and he still looks like a million bucks.
Wow.
He's just awesome. He is a star among stars. And there were any other Felixes they could have gone with or gone back to. Don't know if you could get Jack Lord in 1989. I don't know if that would have played right, but there are other actors. But this just seemed like the right choice, and they seem to generally have some chemistry. I do agree with you that there was a lot of familiarity with Priscilla Barnes as Della.
Like everybody's kissing her.
Pretty much. Yeah, they're all very close. Very, very close.
Yeah, as you do with your close friends.
Sure, sure.
Kiss them all on the mouth, right?
Maybe everybody was just a little bit drunk.
Yeah, it is a wedding.
You know, well, and obviously the bride was a little bit drunk. Yes. And I mean, who wouldn't take advantage of 007?
Oh, that's very true. There, he is James Bond.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, exactly. So, I agree with you both. I think, and two, he actually hurts himself on one of the stunts, and he has a limp in the rest of the movie, because of the parachuting scene.
Wow.
One of the cool things about this movie too is one of Bond's allies who doesn't get out of the office much is Q, and we get to spend a lot of time with Q, and I just love the fact that Q is in the field here helping his friend, and it was kind of nice to see that Q cares about Bond in a way that we maybe had not seen before. Like he likes being in the field. He's like, he's excited the fact that he's out of the office. Like,
yeah, I'm a cool guy too.
Q on vacation.
Yeah, I think Desmond, as a person, is like the cutest old man at this point. So I love him anyway as an actor. But then it's so sweet that you feel like in the past, Q is always so annoyed with Bond. And he's Mr. Cool Guy. And he gets all the gadgets that I spend all of my time on. And he doesn't know how to use them. But now he's, you know, also gone rogue, gone out into the field, taken some things with him to help Bond. It is really nice and does feel like they had a friendship beyond just being coworkers.
He's great. I mean, it's nice to see him in the field. It's nice to see him in some action, whether it's tossing a broom into the shrubs or getting knocked over in a chair by Bond. You know, it's cool to see him out there, and he's wonderful. Q had needed a scene like that from the very beginning. So I'm glad they delivered here.
I love when she's like taking the picture of them, you know, and she's like, smile. And he's like, don't touch that. Like, it's not just 007 right. that does it. It's other right. people too. They just don't respect the property. Yeah. And it's not only that, but I also liked the relationship that he had with Pam. Mm-hmm. Like this, I mean, he's like this grandfather figure, right? And he understands the world in which 007 inhabits and the things that he has to do. He gets that. And I like that there were a couple of scenes where he kind of has to explain that to her. Mm-hmm. Because even though she might work for the CIA, she's an informant, right? She's not an actual agent. So that there's a part of this world that she still doesn't quite get. And so I really thought that that was nice. And just his presence there, having him there more was a lot of fun. Like that added fun without us adding in the JW right. Peppa right. kind of fun, right. which that ain't fun. So, you know, I loved that all the gadgets that he had too, again, they felt very real. It wasn't crazy or outlandish. You know, this all felt like something that you could actually have created at that time period. So that was really
like
nice.
The plastic explosive toothpaste.
Yes. Yeah. The Dentonite. Yeah. So don't brush with Dentonite.
No.
You're right. Not going to be happy. what did you guys think? We have two Bond women in the movie. And so what did you think of Carrie Lowell as Pam? Who's the ex-pilot and, of course, the CIA informant who's been working with Felix.
She is probably one of my most favorite, I would say she's my second favorite Bond woman ever, because she is sitting in that bar with a shotgun under the table and you don't know until she wants you to know. Just for that reason. And then she's also an ex-army pilot, and she's this informant. I mean, she's just in every way Bond's equal, and I love her.
Thus, and we get to Samanth. This is probably the first time I will ever completely disagree with you, only because I think the character is fantastic. I think on paper, this is awesome. I am not a fan of her performance, of Carrie Lowell's performance. And I remember even back in 1989, seeing this for the first time on the big screen, there was something that really, that so did not sit right with me in her performance. I remember quoting and making fun of it when I left the theater with my friends. And I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if it's direction. I don't know what. But her performance never sat right with me. I watched it again thinking, okay, I'm going to see this with some fresh eyes here. And all I could come back to was, man, I wanted this to be better. I think, like mm-hmm. you, yeah, on paper, she's a shotgun-wielding badass who is a good match for Bond. I like the conflicts that they introduce for them. Don't totally buy that they're ready to make out on their second meeting, but whatever, you know, that's fine. It's a Bond movie. I'm okay with that a little bit. But yeah, it fell short of the promise that was there. Like, we've had these Bond women before who they've tried to make equals. You had Major Amasova and The Spy Who Loved Me. Even go further back, and you've got the huge misfire with Mary Goodnight, an agent who should be capable and should be equal, and they just, that did not come together at all. They played her like bad comic relief. They didn't do that here. They didn't diminish the character by making her bad comic relief. Mm-hmm. I just think that either they didn't cast her right or they didn't direct her right. And there are things that in my head, like when she walks up to the bartender at the casino and says, shaken, not stirred, I cringe. I cringe every time.
Because of the hand gesture?
Yeah. Because here's the thing. It should have just been one hand gesture. And you know the look that should have been on her face when she said it. But they messed it up. They mm-hmm. it's not directed right, you know. And even in that scene when Bond confronts her, when he thinks that she's double crossed him, when he sees her meeting with Heller back at the bank, and he goes into the room and he throws it on the bed and he pulls the gun and he's like, "All right, tell me what's going on here." that should have been a really intense scene. He's great in that scene. She's not great in that scene. And it drives me a little crazy that she's not. I want all of that to be awesome. I want all of that to be as good as the rest of the characters in this movie, but it doesn't fire for me.
I get what you're saying, and I didn't really like those two scenes as much either, but I think the one that bothered me the most was at the very end when she's still jealous of Lupe.
I
just thought that they played it, and I don't know if it was her acting or if they, you know, it was direction telling her to play that scene a little bit on the weak emotional side.
Yeah.
Felt silly to me.
Yeah. I wanted to see
and that she then is immediately like, oh, I forgive you.
Yeah. I wanted to see her be tougher. And I think here, you know, nearly 30 years in retrospect, 30 years later, that role would be cast and would be played very differently. I think the idea there works. And I think the dynamic there, the relationship works. But we would see that actually realized in a very different way now.
I'll just be honest. I think both of the women here kind of lack in their range to act. And unfortunately, it is a detriment in the sense that Pam should be somebody who is going toe-to-toe emotionally with Bond in a resonant way. And that scene specifically, I think you called out, John, is when he confronts her on the bed, you know, and he pulls the gun on her and part of that scene is acted okay, and then yes. Part of it's not. Like, I like at the end of the scene where they both kind of, Bond realizes he was wrong, and she realizes that he realizes he's wrong.
Yeah.
And so there's this forgiveness happening between them, and there's this anger and frustration happening all in the scene. And part of it, too, is there's this, the way Dalton acts it, you get this sense that he's different than almost every other Bond, I think, since Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I feel like was the very first one where Bond actually seemed to care about the women that he came in contact with. Timothy Dalton displays a real care about the women he comes in contact with in the movies that he's in. I think it works really well. And in that scene, I totally get that. Because there's that, she kind of leans up against him and he kind of puts his head down to her. And there's this real moment that happens. And that's where I feel like she does nail the scene with him, but it's before that with the accusations going back and forth where I just wanted more. And I agree with Christy too. That scene, you know, where she sees him with Lupe at the very end, and I would have much rather her say something like, Q, let's dance, you know, and like her start dancing with Q and be like, screw that guy. I don't need him, you know? I think that would have been much stronger than, you know, the, oh, I run off and I'm, you know, weepy, you know, Bond doesn't want me. You know, that's not what you want from this character because, you know, the rest of the time, I think she is kind of super badass. And the things that she's doing, I like the way she takes advantage of Wayne Newton, you know, like she totally plays him, you know, right. And the way she uses that overly big dress to her effect of like, you know, she finds the way to show enough leg, you know, and just she knows exactly what she's doing to him and she's got him. Like she does some things really great in this, but you know, I don't think that what you needed is somebody who could match the intensity and the emotion that Dalton gives you in the role, and she doesn't quite do it. But I love the overarching role and the story that she has, you know? So, and I think that's the thing, like, there are some imperfections in the movie, but I think when you kind of put it all together, it does make a more cohesive whole than most Bond movies when you think about what the storyline is for everybody and all of that. It's just not quite as heartily acted as we, you know, desire for sure. So What about Lupe? Because obviously, too, for her, she is a different type of character. She's not the hard ass. She's somebody who got trapped in this world of almost like sex slavery. I mean, you know, she doesn't have anywhere to go or anybody to help her escape, because there is nowhere to escape from for this guy. And I think that part's, I think that part's really good about her performance. But then her delivery on other lines, like, oh, James, it's just like, oh.
Yeah,
she's so tragic.
Yeah. You feel bad for her, but the role overall feels like it fell kind of flat, and that a lot of her delivery is kind of emotionless. Or it, like you said, Matt, with that scene, that she's a little too gaga over Bond, when she should be probably more wary than she is, mm-hmm. since so many people want her. but she does get some really great costuming, and I think both Bond women do. I've got to give a shout out to the purple dress with the ripaway skirt.
That's awesome. I mean, you could cosplay with that, Christy. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Hide a gun in fake gun.
Whoa. Watch out, Michael. That's Christy's husband for all the listeners.
So I'll take up a contrary position here, not just because I'm feeling particularly contrarian today, but I, in watching this movie the first time around, I remember thinking that Lupe was okay. Watching it, and I've seen it many times over the years, but studying it again for this show, I really liked her performance a lot more, and really keyed into the tragedy of who she was and what was going on. In every scene, I thought you could read that there are a few motivations going on here. There's self-protection. There's the feeling that she can't escape where she is, that she's only as good as where she is. And then trying to use the only tools she has in her arsenal to try to get out. If it means seducing Bond, it means seducing Bond. And not that I think that she's playing it in any way disingenuously, but that's all she knows. I think there's a lot going on with this character. And I also think that Talisa Soto plays that character with more maturity than she was like 20 years old when they made this movie. And I think she brings more to that role than certainly a lot of 20-year-old actors. I liked her performance. Again, I don't think it's, you know, the best of all Bond women we've ever seen. But I got more out of it this time than I had in the past.
And I actually agree with you in that sense, that I rewatching it, I felt for both of the women, you know, like what they're supposed mm-hmm. to be giving. I think in the end, what I wanted was just a little bit more, and part of that was mainly just the naturalism and delivery. I think that's really the only thing that would have helped in some of their readings and some of their lines. Other than that, I think the roles and, again, how they fit in the story are great. I wanted to ask you guys about the action in this movie, because I feel like this has some of the coolest, well-staged action sequences that also feel very real of any Bond movie up to this point.
Yeah. I will hearken back to seeing Jaws on the airplane scene. I thought that was also really good in, you know, some of the other Bond action that we've seen. But I do think that this is pretty high up there on great Bond action scenes. I especially really liked the water skiing happening in this one, and then the truck scene at the end more than I did the plane parachuting at the very beginning. Felt a little bit like the whole mission was too easy for Felix and Bond, and of course then we find out that it was. But I do think that the water stunts and things going on in this movie were just stand out for me above everything else. I mean, the scuba divers, the water skiing, the you know, underwater devices like the, what do they call it? The submarine or whatever he had, Crest had.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I mean, Timothy Dalton has great physicality without you ever feeling that he's inhuman. And that's the problem with a lot of action movies today, is that you have actors and who just have terrific physicality. They can be in a fight scene or whatever, but there's a certain level of removal for you in the audience that you just don't believe what they're doing. That opening airplane stunt, yeah, they played it smart where it felt too easy, because it was too easy, but it was a great scene. Not as much a favorite for me as the opening of Living Daylights, because come on, what an entrance for a new Bond, you know? But it's fantastic. The hardware felt real. The shots felt real. To see that helicopter fly by with a plane dangling from it, it's a real thing, you know? And yeah, the water stunts were great. Even the water skiing scene, had this been another movie, then you would have cued a Beach Boys song and you would have cut to a green screen and you would have lost all investment in the moment. But in this, you really felt like, oh, wow.
Everybody's gone surfing. Surfing USA.
And not only do you feel like it's happening, you feel like it's difficult to do and it's happening. You know, the physicality in this is awesome. This is really good. Even a little moment like Lupe leaving Sanchez's house in the boat, and then Bond popping up from the side where he's been hiding underwater. You know, there's Timothy Dalton actually doing that stunt. Not a very complex stunt, but it's a stunt.
Well, yeah, he did the plane stunt as much as he could. And in fact, Cubby was not happy when he came to see where they were filming that and to see his actor on the wire. He was really displeased, to say the least. You know, so wow. Timothy Dalton was very keen, as a lot of actors are, but I think even than some of the other Bonds, very keen to do as many of the stunts as possible. And you can tell. I also like the scene where he has to swim from the pilot ship down underneath and back up. And you can tell that when he gets up, you know, he's been holding his breath for a while. And it feels that realistic, like it was almost too far, you know? I really like that. I feel like that the truck sequences are just phenomenal. With these, I mean, just massive real gas explosions, which it's great because it doesn't feel fake in the sense of like we're just trying to make it bigger. These are actually tanker trucks full of gas. So they would explode with just massive fireballs. And so everything about that feels gritty and real. And the fights that are happening on those trucks feel great. You know, there's only a couple of insert scenes of people inside trucks where you can tell that's on a stage, but the rest of it feels so good and realistic that I just, it's a movie that's kind of a joy to watch because you feel like you are in the midst of the action with Bond, and the action feels real enough to make you feel the pain that he's feeling when he gets thrown off a truck, or, you know, any of these things that happen to him, or when he's almost had a whole building fall on him, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I think it's really well done. So, just huge kudos to them for raising the bar of the action, but also making it feel grounded enough that you're not like, oh, space lasers. You know, so.
Although I think we could have done away with the shark. I don't think that that was really that scary. I think that they could have done an injury to Felix differently in the same environment. It just doesn't come across believable to me.
Yeah. The shark itself is not scary in the sense because it doesn't look real. But what it does to Felix is definitely looks real. So I think that's the part. Right. Yeah, I totally get it. I mean, yeah, this is I wanted to ask before we get to ratings what you guys thought of the music. I thought it was interesting that originally Vic Flick, who played the guitar lead in the original Bond theme, had written a song with Eric Clapton for the movie, and they reject it. Mm-hmm. I was like, I want to hear that song! Right?
Maybe one day. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just shocked. Like, you have the guy, the original creator of the Bond theme, he gets together with Eric Clapton, writes a Bond song, and they're like, we'll bring in Gladys Knight instead. Like, there's nothing wrong with Gladys
Knight. We're not
big
Eric Clapton
fans. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could have been along the lines with Live and Let Die, you know, having another Paul McCartney kind of person. You know, I think that would have been incredible. So it's really unfortunate that they turned it down. But I think that I liked the score better than I liked the song. I think that especially, I did want to say, even though the scene didn't really make sense for the timing, in the boat scene where Bond is riding away with Pam, and, you know, they're about to kiss or whatever, the music there is just beautiful. And I think it comes back again and again. So I loved the score for this movie, and I really noticed it. But yeah, License to Kill, the opening, and then the song at the credits, I wasn't a huge fan of.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a big fan of the Beastie Boys. I think this is one of their seminal albums. We're talking about License to Kill,
yeah,
not License that, to...
No, no Sabotage nice. On this album. Yeah.
No? Okay. Just wanted to make sure. No, I'm about 75% of the way there on the score. I think the strong numbers in that score are really strong, and the reuses of the Bond theme mostly are really good. There's a couple of arrangements that I'm not crazy about, but it's also just a little bit dated in that kind of late 90s way. Theme song, you could tell that if they're going to give up something like Monty Norman and Vic Flick, which just sounds, I'm sorry, Vic Flick and Eric Clapton, which just sounds like a crazy thing to not do, then they really felt like, okay, we have to do something that sounds exactly like a derivative of an older Bond theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Which they tried to do, and sure, it's all right, but it's ultimately forgettable because all you do then is think about the originals. You think about Goldfinger, and you think about the other tracks that it was riffing on. Mm-hmm. So, I think the score is really nice. Like I said, a couple of clunkers in there, but for the most part, it's a really strong score.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because you've got Michael Kamen doing the score, and he's doing it because John Barry's just had surgery. And so he couldn't, and he'd already scored, you know, Lethal Weapon and Die Hard. So he's very familiar with doing these action scenes. And I think he does a really great job. I think that's actually where the tracks that I really loved the most seem to shine. He's great at the action. And it sounded mm-hmm. like a good classic Bond score. So I really had no problems with that. I do agree with you both. I feel like the song, the opening theme song is so, it's just so vanilla. It feels it's like safe. You've just poured out vanilla. And the opening credits are actually that way too. There's nothing exciting about the opening credits. They just feel like laziness when it comes to Bond credits. So there's just nothing to love in that. But the score itself, yeah, works for the movie, and I didn't really have any issues with it. So, all in all, as we bring out, our License to Rate, Christy, what would you rate License to Kill?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
You got a license to rate. Nice. Go straight to
your heart.
You got
a lot of great title options. I would say I rate this actually pretty high, and would give it an 8 out of 10 for me because of all of the areas where it really hits on all cylinders. I think that the villains stand out amazingly in this movie. And I like that it's not just one guy, and it's not just one guy hiding behind a computer. You know, it's a guy that really gets in the field and works on things himself. I love Timothy Dalton. I'm sad that this is, you know, our last movie with him. I like the serious tone and the fact that he gets to avenge his friends. But I thought that, you know, like I said, the bloody stuff went a little too far for me. And even though I did love 9 times out of 10 the character of Pam, I do agree with John that there were a couple places where she kind of bugged me too. So yeah, I give it an 8 out of 10. And I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 leg straps for a gun or like Pam would have.
Nothing like a thigh strap.
Yeah. And my favorite quote was, I really like that moment where at the boat scene and then again at the end where she says, why don't you wait until you're asked? And she says, well, why don't you ask me? I thought that was cute.
It's weird, you know, rewatching all of these movies sort of changes my perception of them. So when we were doing the Moore era, I remember liking Live and Let Die a lot less than I thought I did. I remember liking The Man with the Golden Gun more than I thought I did. This time around, rewatching The Living Daylights, I remember liking it a lot more than I thought I would. Because at the time these came out, I was sort of middle of the road about that one. But now watching these in context again and in order and talking with you guys, I really appreciate that movie a lot more. Watching this movie again, I'm going to give it some points off. And here's why. I think you guys are right on. I think the story is awesome. I think Timothy Dalton is awesome. He is so criminally underrated and underused, clearly, as Bond.
Yes.
We only got 2 movies out of him. Just completely unfair. And it really felt like they knew what to do with him, you know, which is great. They sort of reinvented the movies around him where they could. Not always, but for the most part. And I think the villain here really works. I think the world that he's in really works. However, I have to give some points off, some big, big points off for production value. There's a lot in this movie that feels very pedestrian, that even though it's real world, it still feels kind of cheap. It feels made for TV. I also can't get around Cary Lowell a lot in this. So there are just things that take me out of the movie. So I might have given it a 7 if I'm feeling really generous, but today I'm just feeling very contrarian, so I'm going to give it 6 out of 10 tubes of Dentonite toothpaste. I might even adjust that up to like the 6.5 or a little, you know, creeping a little closer to 7, depending on if I watch it again and maybe I go back and rewatch that airplane scene at the beginning or the water skiing or some of the other really daring stunts. Maybe I creep up a little bit higher, closer to 7, but I'm not quite there at this moment.
You know, it's funny. For me, I think I have always liked this movie more than other people. Now, John, I am going to go with you in the sense that when we watched Living Daylights, that movie just blew my expectations away because I remember not liking that one at all. And then we watched it and now it's in like my top 11 or top 10 of Bond films. Strangely enough, it knocked this one out of place number 9 to number 10. On my list. So, but this movie still does, I think, hold up. And what it shows me is that even as you said, John, production value isn't quite the same in some places, especially maybe in lighting and those kind of staging. There are some issues with the actresses and their portrayal. But the story overall is so strong when it comes to Bond films. In fact, I would venture to say, up to this point, this may be one of the best Bond stories, the most cohesive Bond stories when it comes to when you break down what's actually happening in the story. all the stuff makes sense here. You're not left with any lingering feelings like, huh, really? What? All the pieces seem to really fit. And so that, to me, is great. And then you put on top of that that Dalton is just, you know, acting his PPK out. And it's just, it's really good. And it is sad that people did not respond to this. And part of that, I think, is that this is one of the hardest-edged Bond films until we got Craig. And probably this is the hardest-edged Bond film until we get Craig. And I don't know if people were quite ready for that yet. Christy, I don't think people were quite ready for the violence in a Bond movie yet like this. I don't know. But for me, personally, I really like this Bond movie. And to me, I will be there right with you, Christy. This is a clear 7.5 out of 10 shark bites. Yeah, it's just really, I think it's a Bond movie that you can enjoy and put on. And honestly, it's because Timothy Dalton just makes this role completely his own. And it'll be interesting to go back and see if my very first Bond movie that I saw in the theaters lives up with, as we'll dive into, Brosnan's Goldeneye. So I'm just really excited that we have reached the Brosnan era. And you know what? It's crazy. We only have 4 more Bond films to cover.
Wow.
5. 4.
Man.
5. 4.
4. Okay. I think it was 4.
Yeah, it's 4. I was thinking 5 because if we do Say Never Again. So anyway. Anyway.
Yeah, that'll be
interesting. Yes. So excited that we have gotten this opportunity. I love getting to talk Bond with you guys. And this one was a really fun one to do. And so thank you to our associate producers, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson. You guys make this happen with your support of the network here through Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm. It's a massive thing that we're doing here at Trek FM with all the shows we're doing. There's no way we can do it without you. Every little bit helps that you can contribute. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm, see how you can become part of the team today. And we've got great ways that we love giving back to you. So there are different support levels you can be at, and there's different perks that come with those. So again, it's patreon.com/trekfm. Now, Christy, thank you so much for being back. It's been a pleasure to have you here in the 602 Club. But let everybody know where they can find you if they want to talk with more Bond with you or what else you've got going on.
Sure. I always love coming here and talking Bond and can't believe we've only got 4 or 5 more left.
I know. Sad face.
It feels so short. Yeah. But when I'm not here on 602 Club, I'm also on every month with my co-host Teresa Delgado on Galactic Fashion, talking about all of the geek fashion coming out. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Galactic Fashion Pod. And then you can find me personally on both Instagram and Twitter as well at Bespin Bell. And I also write for StarWarsReport.com and FangirlNextDoor.com.
Awesome. Awesome. And make sure you're checking Christy out with what she's doing. If you're not following on Instagram and seeing the adorable fashion that she's got going on, I mean, she rivals John for fashion. So, but for women,
slow-mo
obviously.
Lady.
John's not usually rocking the BB-8 dress. John, where can everybody find you? Because you are a man about town.
Well, I try to be, like a shark, gotta keep swimming, gotta keep moving,
Just keep swimming. Just
after you've
swimming.
Had a nice full meal of Felix's left leg.
wow, that just took a left turn in Weirdville.
It did. So you can find me on Mission Log, missionlogpodcast.com, part of the Roddenberry Podcast Network, podcast.roddenberry.com. As we record this, I'm gearing up to do a live show tonight. We do Tuesdays live now on Facebook at 7 p.m. Pacific, so I hope you all will join us there. And you can find me personally at DVD Geeks, also on Instagram, jchamp72, or Slow Mo Gentleman. I had to say that one a little more slowly.
You do need to be following the slow-mo gentleman, yes. Because... you can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02, and of course I'm on Instagram under that same name. I am not as cool or slow-mo as my friend here, but follow me anyway. You could find me here on the network doing We're All About Deep Space Nine. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter with my good friend Dre Kaufman on Owlpost as we walk through each and every chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. I'm doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. We talk all things Star Wars. We're so excited. As we're recording this, Star Wars Rebels has just ended. We got some big things coming up, so make sure you check that out. And, of course, you can find me doing Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney as we kind of talk through films through the lens of faith. And it's just so much fun to really dive in that way. So I hope you'll check out all of those shows. You can find all the shows that everyone has mentioned on the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and I highly encourage you to check every one of them out. But thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear? Recording. Everybody's recording. Yep. Christy's recording. Everybody John is recording. Everybody's recording. All right. Everybody was recording audio. Wow. Okay.